Hi, I'm David Miller.
Hi, I'm Mikkel Rasmussen.
Welcome to Off Bike. This is a bit of a weird off bike episode, in the sense it's about us, Mikkel and I. I met Mikkel just over a year ago, March, April 2019. We were riding bikes in Girona. We had that weird connection on the bike where we shared the same dark humour. Yet we never crossed paths off the bike. On the final evening, at dinner, we found ourselves sitting next to each other. He was a bit of a mystery to me, and against my better judgment, I asked him, "Who are you? What do you do?" He replied, "I'm an anthropologist." That was it. I was hook, line, and sinker. Yet even a year spent becoming friends didn't enlighten me to who or what he was. So I went to Copenhagen to learn more. And that's what this episode is about.
And, we're walking in the Royal Gardens in Copenhagen, middle of Copenhagen. Walking towards the old castle. And you can see the flowers are coming up from the ground, different colors. There are people walking their dogs, two crazy guys doing a podcast, and a lot of Renaissance design. People from Copenhagen are super proud about this. There's even a word called to Copenhagenize a city, what it means is it's actually not so sophisticated. It's just, let's make a street for cyclists, and let's make little lights for cyclists, and let's prioritize the bike over the car, just as a principle. Live in Copenhagen and not have a bike, it's just not possible. And you understand all of a sudden that the bike is the city. It's not the other way around. The Danes have a tendency to think that they're so great and that they invented everything. But really, we didn't invent anything. We're just, you know, tradespeople. And so therefore, I'm not so fond of us saying we came up with this idea. I think it happened out of necessity. You can find many other cities that also has that character, but they don't brag about it. So, you know, I think Danes are really basically sneaky people. They pretend that they are sort of not bragging about anything, but then they brag a lot.
You know who are great inventors there? Scottish.
In what way?
We've invented loads of things. I'll look them up later. I'll put them in the show notes.
Really?
Yeah, I will. But there's another thing I educated about you about yesterday about Copenhagen, just to bring Copenhagen up a little or down level. Copenhagen, for those to save you looking at a map, is at the same latitude as Glasgow. So, you know, it's two great cities.
It explains a lot.
Hello, Mikkel. We are, where are we?
We are in Copenhagen right now, my town, and we are in my office right now.
I'd say you gave me a tour of Copenhagen yesterday, but I kind of ended up giving you a tour, as considering we got on the metro and you're all blasé about it, and then you had to ask a flower seller how we get out of the metro.
That is true. What I discovered was, I don't know my own town, which is actually a anthropological technique called breaching. And the idea is most people have no clue where they are and what they do. They just do it. Like, I wake up, I put on my clothes, I go to work, and it becomes like you don't see the world you live in. It's hidden for you.
I show people around Girona when they come cycling, and I take them out for a ride. I see everything with fresh eyes.
Yeah.
You're actually looking around because you're showing things. You're like, oh, wow, that's beautiful. And you just, because you're so used to, my old training routes, just, they become embedded, imprinted. Then you go with somebody else and it's like seeing it again for the first time. That's breaching, okay.
In my school, I lived in the suburbs at that time with my dad. I went to a school, and one of the teaching methods was to watch documentaries and films. At that time, it was real films. Like, you ordered a roll at the State Film Institute, and it would come like in a big package, and the teacher would put it on and go, and the film started. I didn't know anything about cycling much, right? Yeah. And I was quite young, I think it was about 8, 9, around there, right? And it was this film about the race and what happened. And I particularly remember a scene when they come back after, you know, getting into the velodrome of Obey. And they stand in the shower and they look like horses. Like, it's like,
these boxes, yeah. like when you wash a horse.
It's the concrete.
And they had like mud all over, and you can just see the tiredness in their bodies. And you'd hear your Let's voice, they are taking a shower. Because he's very factful.
Yeah, like, it's very monotone. Yes.
And he does not, he doesn't say what he thinks, right? Which we'll come back to why he doesn't do that, because he is very inspired by anthropology, it turns out, and a specific type of anthropology, but where you describe the world, and when you do that with the facts and the objects that are in the world, and just focus on that, it reveals how rich the world really is, because we never notice those things.
Yeah.
And so he'd be going, the man on his bike, his shoes have been tight, mud on his knee.
Yeah.
And it's like, you'd go like that. And it's and it'll be like a 30 minutes, it doesn't say anything.
Yeah.
But, so I saw that film and I became obsessed with cycling, like, and I've been since. I think I became a fan of Eddie Max, which is crazy. And I had posters in my room with Eddie and who looked like Elvis on a bike.
Yeah.
It was almost like the cyclist as a pop star for a teenager, right? That was it. And I asked my dad, can I get a race bike? And he said, no, but you can do paper rounds and I'll show you how to save up. So I did paper rounds and I saved up for this orange Eddie Merckx bike that I bought in Belgium. And started and thought, now I want to be Eddie Merckx. But that failed.
Yeah, no one's done that yet. But then you had an interesting phenomenon, which I think is quite hard to comprehend now for the modern cyclist, is that back then cycling was a very working class sport.
Yes. I'm sorry, but I'm born in the middle upper class. And at that time also the society was more class divided because there were real workers, right? People in my class would have parents that worked in a factory, which is unheard of today. Yeah. Like there are no factories in Denmark. Like I don't think so. Right? I know anyone who works in a factory. Mm. And there was a division of sports also, and cycling was not for middle and upper class kids. And you were clearly told that when you started. Not directly, but in this rule-based way. So I remember the first thing they did was plumb your gears. Because you're too young to change gears, because you have to get training your muscles.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not a very middle class thing, like to train your muscles. Mm-hmm. Like to, you know, it's all about mind.
Yeah? Mm-hmm.
And so they plumbed the gears.
What does that mean, plumbed the gears?
That means if I had seven gears and they plumbed and put a little metal thing around them so you can only use one gear. Another thing would be the first training ride I went on. We were going up the coast, and there was like a headwind. And I didn't know that it's hard to ride in the wind. The technique was go as fast as you can up against the wind until the first guy pukes. And then we go home, race home, right? I was dropped after 2 minutes, I think on purpose in a way. I remember it was raining, it was wind, and they just, I didn't know where I was. At that time, no GPS.
Yeah.
And just came home, felt like, such a loser. I also participated in a race where I went the wrong way. And I asked one of those guards, which way is it? And he just said, idiot.
Fast forward a few years, you were then sent to London by your dad. Can you explain that?
No. No, yeah, I was him and my mom, who were divorced, probably thought I needed some education and needed, I don't know, discipline, whatever. Mm. They just thought, we'll send him to London for a year. I was 15, 16. So I spent a year there. I was sent to Leytonstone in East London. Again, a very working class neighborhood at that time, very rough.
Yeah.
But also very, very wonderful. And I stayed with a family there in a house for a year. I was not very good at English at that point. I remember getting into class first day, and there's this bloke next to me saying, "Oh, mate, you've got a spare pen?" And I had no clue what he was talking about. A completely different school system.
Mm.
You sit in this classroom with, I remember like 40 kids in school uniforms, and you're lectured by this old man with a moustache and a tweed suit. The books were super old. Like they were, I had a math book from 1936. So I was sitting in this in a foreign language, being taught something I had no clue what was, in a context that was completely foreign to me.
Yeah.
And it was the most beautiful, fun experience, rich experience I've ever had, right? In a way, I became a little bit of a sort of human researcher in that class. Really interested in, for example, what is it like to be a 16-year-old boy in East London? And it happens that it's very, very different from a country not far away that I'm from. Like, nothing compares.
Yeah.
And so it was a rich, wonderful experience, I think.
Were you a different person?
Completely. I came back as an independent human being, first of all. I discovered my own being in a way, like I'm here, right? And I can go left and right. Nobody has to tell me what to do. I came back as a little bit of a rebel too, I think. And I came back with a much, much broader understanding of who are the others, like the English, and I've used it since, right? The same skill of not taking for granted that the stereotype of, let's say, what's Britishness is something you can read. You'd have to be there. Like, just eating was amazing for me because at home, I didn't know the concept of fast food. I'd never heard about frozen food. We didn't have a freezer in my home. Mm. And in the family I stayed in, big, big, big freezer, and they put it into the freezer. It would be fish fingers and,
beans
and maybe on a good day, there'd be, green peas or something like that. And then they would eat in front of the telly, right, in a big sofa. And all my friends did that, right? Yeah. And that was unheard of in my home. In my home, we ate at 6. You sat down, you had conversations, you'd talk about what you did during the day and so on. And I'm not saying one thing is good and another thing is bad. I'm just saying I loved it. Like, I thought it was amazing.
So when you came back, this is where I was surprised when I found this out. You chose a direction that perhaps would have been unexpected 2 or 3 years before.
You mean for my academic career? Well, it's not as simple as that because I had a couple of years where I played punk music. I dyed my hair white, like Billy Idol. So I looked like Billy Idol in a way, like when I was young, and had this sort of rebel lifestyle for 2 years, and then I said, "No, this is not me." I tried that now, and then I applied for university, and I started studying economics in a very special part of economics, which is called econometrics, which is modeling economic behavior and modeling, like if you want to build, let's say, a hospital, figuring out, is it worthwhile for society, like cost-benefit analysis? Say if this becomes nerdy, but at that time there was a very simple model for what is growth that was based on labor and capital, like the combination of those two. So either you have like a factory or you have labor, and that's the only way you can grow. And it just couldn't explain innovation, technology. Like, so you'd use the same model to explain society in 1600s and now. Mm. What I was frustrated about was, well, if you take the richest societies and the poorest societies, it's not just how productive you are with labor and capital. Mm. It's also how smart you are, right? How many inventions, like the plane, is not just a mix of labor and capital. Mm. It's also ideas and technology. Yeah. And it has a different economic and mathematical, by the way, logic than what's called linear growth. It, for example, has exponential functions. It has chaos, randomness, which is my favorite mathematical topic, by the way. Mm. Randomness is fantastic. This is getting too nerdy. Anyway, but I was super interested in what's called growth theory and started reading a book by a guy called Paul Romer, still a very interesting guy, who made the first growth model of an economy, explaining why rich carpenters are rich and poor countries are poor. Poor in a way that's meaningful to most people, which is rich countries happen to have more scientists, more educated people, more technology, better infrastructure. And it's not just about, you know, how capital and labor. I got specialized in that. I got super interested in innovation. Not at that time, it wasn't about inventing products, but I was the phenomena of, like, if you imagine society as a bunch of ants, everything we do is so predictable, like when you watch an ant colony. Society is, for an economist, is like that. Like, yeah. It's just patterns of behavior, right? Or what's called flows. Mm-hmm. Right? Flows of money, flows of capital, flows of people, flows of goods. Yeah. That's all it is. And it's all numbers, right? Mm. And models. And but what we could not explain is, why doesn't the ant farm grow? Like, right. why do we expand? Why are we, how can we do that? So I was super interested in looking at innovation from that perspective. Right? What happens with an ant colony if the ants all of a sudden get planes, right? Yeah. Or, you know, infrastructure like fast broadband network or telephones or radio, for that matter. Like, what happens to human behavior as a whole, not individually? Mm. And as you know, and like anybody knows, when a new technology enters a society, like planes, everything changes. Right? Yeah. For example, globalization comes not from capital and labor, it comes from technology. Yeah. And I was just super... Anyway, so I went to the school where the best professors were, and I wrote them a letter and said, look, I don't know how to apply for a foreign university. Probably not qualified to study with you, but is there a way? And they wrote me back instantly and said, read this book, come down here next month. And I came down and I joined this group of 10 people, like, that were students, this little cult of nerds doing the same, like, modeling growth, right? And that became my sort of profession.
You went into governmental, political modeling, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, I did. Yeah. Because where do you go if you know how a society works? Or I didn't know, but you have the tools to study it at least. Mm. Or put another way, how do you create a good society?
Yeah.
Like, if you know that, at least I pretended I knew and had some models to do it. Like,
no one else knew.
Yeah. There are only two jobs. Like, yeah. You can go into academia and do a PhD. And I hated academia for one reason is the way they communicate in academia, still do, through these papers and seminars, super boring. And I just couldn't see myself doing that.
Yeah.
So the other option was government. And I was really, really lucky to get a job in government with one of the most visionary civil servants, who also happened to be an economist, by the way. And he became my mentor, and I taught me the art of civil service. Right? One of the things I learned in working for government was if you're skilled in a certain thing, it doesn't matter if it doesn't work politically. Right? Yeah. So you can't be naive. And I remember writing my first memo to a minister, and it had seven layers. At that time, it was before the computer.
Yeah.
And you would put them your memo into a folder of a specific color saying you are a low working guy, right? You're low in the hierarchy. And it would move up.
Literally just to somebody else.
To your next box and next box. And you get it back with, you know, feedback. Mm. And they'll correct your particularly your language. Mm. And I wrote a letter starting like this. Dear Minister, I really think you should consider, I don't know what it was, but I used. And I got a letter back from the boss saying, Mikkel, you are a smart guy, but as a civil servant, you never talk about yourself. You never use grammatically, you know, the
first
personal.
Pronoun.
No.
Mm, yeah.
You use third person and you write passive. Mm. So you would say one things like, or you'd say it would be beneficial if.
Okay, so literally a servant of the country.
Yes.
And so you don't exist essentially.
No. Yeah. And which makes the letter unpersonal, and it doesn't really matter who wrote it, right?
Yeah.
And then I also discovered that at that time, civil servants would spend more time fighting each other, and ministers fighting the one minister fighting the other, the educational minister fighting the minister of finance.
Politics.
Yeah, politics. And I do not like politics. I think it would be great if we didn't have it. And I knew pretty early on that if there was a way to do something else, then I would probably do that. And that happened many years later. I was there for many years.
Okay, I'm going to go and speak to a couple of people, and then we'll go on to the next act.
Okay.
All right, guys, where are we?
We're not used to being interviewed very often.
I'm usually on the other end of it.
We are in a somewhat palatial 19th century mansion in the middle of Copenhagen at Red Associates, home and birthplace of Red Associates here in Copenhagen. Red Associates is a consulting firm which basically uses social science research to solve big, juicy, weird questions sometimes for companies. Things like... I did a project a few years ago that was about the future of air pollution. So trying basically to understand, we studied in cities that have had massive rises in air pollution, somewhere like Beijing. We basically studied what is it, like how does air pollution feel on a daily basis to someone who lives in Beijing? Like how do you start changing the way you commute and where you go to work and where you take your kids to play and like the conversations you have with their teachers? And try to understand that basically to figure out not just where is air pollution going to be in the future and what should governments do about it, but is there anything that we can do to help people on a daily basis to deal with air pollution more? We called that project The Future of Air.
Small project then.
Yeah, small project. Apparently breathing's important. Definitely a crazy project. I mean, we've done projects on the future of augmented reality, hearing, sound, sports, national identity. All these kind of things. Sound, yeah.
Podcast relevant.
It's the podcast relevant sound.
Yeah, well, yeah. I think sound seems to be okay so far. Can you give me your names, your background, as in your education and specialization?
Sure. My name is Thomas Hughes, and I am a recently graduated PhD in anthropology. My specialization, I guess, as an academic was in medical anthropology and studies of disability. So at Red, I've done a ton of different projects about what does it mean to live with, for example, hemophilia, and how can you create a better life for people with hemophilia or people with end-stage cancer. One of the most powerful projects I've ever done at Red was talking to people with stage 4 lung cancer, going around Denmark and basically seeing people who are just going right right at the kind of eclipse of their life. And it's quite, I mean, existentially, I don't think it gets heavier. Wow. But yeah, it's quite rewarding as well. So
I'm Ian Dull, like flat, boring, or stupid. I have been a bit peripatetic, like all over the place in my education. So I started in literature and then switched to architecture. So I have some of a design background and then switched back to literature and then back to architecture and worked in actual historic preservation for several years in a few different places, and then took a degree in, did my master's in archaeology and anthropology, and went in as someone who had more of a design and probably, you know, interest in material culture and left more as an anthropologist, and wound up working for several years at UNESCO, working on and with other people, working to try to like sustain the culture around monuments and things like that. And at some point, I guess surprisingly got, disillusioned with the public sector and, you know, a lot of the work of international organizations, and stumbled across Red and thought that actually it would be interesting to see, you know, what the world of anthropology that I'd been trained in, that I, you know, sort of moved by, could do in terms of, you know, really being applied in detail and that kind of thing. I think I found that a lot of, even in a very like anthropological space, like cultural heritage, a lot of the way of applying anthropology was very broad and very you know, not super attentive.
In concrete,
and not very super attentive to details and the realities on the ground, very politicized in the way that it was talked about. And I came to Red and sort of discovered that it was refreshing how, you know, concrete and detailed and, you know, rich a lot of the questions we got to take on were. So I guess in some way we are super spoiled in that we get to be really nerdy for a living.
Yeah. What I find so exciting about the work we do here is that we get to have an impact. We get to see changes in the world. We get to basically, as an academic, you could get away with being extremely fluffy and never actually really engaging with the world and society. And here we're forced to come up with solutions to problems, not just identify problems and point to them and describe them, but put all the chips in, really bet on this is what I think will help, and I'll put my career on the line for it.
My name is Martin, and I'm from Denmark, and I've been with Red for 12 years now. The reason why I picked Red, and I guess I've picked it ever since, was every project we do is about being curious on one aspect of what it means to be human, and therefore what life is about. And every one of those lunch conversations you hear here, every one where you hear what happens on a project, is fundamentally interesting. Mm. Also, for someone like me who thinks a lot like, what's the meaning of life and who am I and what's a good life? For me, having that constant stimuli from my colleagues and the projects we do is extremely rewarding on a level that the other track just couldn't honor and wasn't interesting.
So we left it where you were years in the public sector and then got disillusioned.
Yes. I was asked by my boss, because I told him I'm so sick and tired of all of it, and he said, why, I mean, you were very good at critiquing everything. Why don't you build something? I built a place called Mind Lab, it was called, which was a little organization with five people whose mission it was to challenge policies and challenge thinking in the public sector, particularly around politics, economics, and so on. And the reason for that was we would be writing government reports about how industry needed to be more innovative. And I felt so shitty doing that, because how would I know, right? I'm sitting there in, you know, some building somewhere with my models, being super smart about something, I have no clue what it is, right? And I started being interested in, so you have macroeconomics and microeconomics. In microeconomics, and sort of also, what is innovation? Like, how does it work? And I came across a whole bunch of interesting places like MIT Media Lab, the design company called IDEO, really interesting projects where you could see how are new things shaped. Like, how do you make a running shoe? Like, how do you invent a running shoe or a car? And so on. I got interested in that. And I thought maybe you could apply those methods in government. And there are some really good principles in that, I think, which is to be curious, for example. And governments are not curious. To, you know, test and experiment. To be interested in the world outside you, like the users, the customers, the stakeholders. To partner with people who you usually do not partner with, like tech companies do or innovative companies do, like sub-suppliers, for example. So I created this place, and then it was quite fun. And, had a couple of artists assigned to do the room. And I remember I said to them, look, I want you to provoke as artists. I want you to make a building into an art object. And they came and they said, well, we want to create a giant egg inside the building that's called the mind. And it should symbolize your headspace. And it's a giant white egg. Like, I'm saying giant. Like, so you could walk into this egg.
Yeah.
You'd be able to draw on the walls and sort of brainstorm on the walls and so on. And it was like a crazy idea. I was really afraid, like, because you do not do that in a ministry, right?
Yeah.
And I was mocked and people laughed at me.
but it became an art project, and you know, there's books written about it, photo exhibitions. So I did that, and then because of that and all the publicity that came out of that, I was basically headhunted to work in a design agency for a couple of years as an executive there, doing product design, product innovation. And there I started applying analytical techniques. So I found designers that would work by just, you know, they would, so they had to create something like, say, a new name for a car. And the way they would come up with this new name for the car would be, let's have 5,000 names, and then, you know, which one do we feel is the best name? Like, you had this brainstorming, I think it's a sickness, like if you just have enough ideas, and if they're wild enough, then one of them ought to have, be good. And that's, I started to challenge that and say, no, you can work much more analytically with design. So, for example, if it's a car, figure out what's the history of that car, how, what's mobility today to people, what does the brand want to stand for, etc. Like, analyze those. What does the market look like, etc. The same thing with product design. If we're designing a, for example, a shoe for sports performance, like, then go and stay with runners and understand how they make sense of the world. And through that, I got to know the whole field of anthropology, because by coincidence, I worked on a medical project about ostomy care, and we hired anthropologists to go and study these people, and I was just, wow. What they came back with was like nothing in my models could ever get close to it. And it's, so if you talk about macroeconomics and microeconomics, this is like it's like really understanding details about how people live, how they move about, what they do, and so on. And I thought, wow, this is a way to look at the world that is completely new to me. And then through many things, I met a couple of other people. One of them was in the company, and two of them was in the company. And then we created the Red out of boredom and out of not being able to keep a job and not wanting to be in a brainstorming culture, but wanted to create a sort of analytical way to think about innovation at that point. And it's called Red because... we would claim that it's research and development. And if you take research and development and look at, write it with the and, it actually says red, if you put the letters very close.
Oh, the ampersand,
And it becomes red, which is also funny because a lot of the theory that we base our studies on are Marxist theories, right? They come from, not politically, but the analytical angle, which is understanding how structures in society shape individuals and not the other way around, which is what's called a Marxian analysis, right? That we think we're individuals, but we are really guided by a structure. So it's a little paranoid way of thinking, but there's a, it's really nice way to understand many things, like how is a t-shirt produced, like you've showed me. It's basically the same idea that it's a structure. It's not just a t-shirt, like there's a structure producing that t-shirt. For example, there are fashion companies that motivate people to buy a certain product, and they do it not to keep them warm, but to give them status. Right? Mm-hmm. Social status is a structure, and it's predictable. It's not chaos.
It's almost like it was a next generation mind lab, and then but then when you started it with, was it three other people? So there's four of you. Did you have clients when you started it?
It's a good question. I can tell we had a lot of cash flow problems, to put it mildly, and we weren't paid. But we had an office, the office we're in right now, which is beautiful. We very quickly got some of the biggest companies in the world as clients. We didn't do much to get them. They came to us almost, right? And we met them. The first one was Lego, where we got into a conversation, we met them, and they were in big trouble. They've basically lost their connection with kids and parents, and they were basing a lot of decisions on assumptions about play and being a parent, being a kid, and so on. We interviewed 30 executives there, and then we wrote down what do they believe, which is a technique we use. We call it the mirror. So you basically ask people what they believe, and afterwards you show them, is it true, this is what you believe? And then they say yes. Then you go out and say, how does that test out in the real world, those assumptions? A good example would be on that list of they had like five big ones. One of them was PlayStation is taking everything. This is in 2004. The plastic brick has had its time. The physical world is disappearing. Kids are now only playing with digital things, and we're not competitive in that space. Or another one, which was the problem with kids is that they used to have much more ability to focus, and kids have lost their attention. And they were basing this on their observation of their own children. So they had all these assumptions. And then they got a new CEO also, that a young guy who looked at it and just saw a company losing money, bleeding money. And we got to do a project which was framed around a question called why do kids play? Most like studies of human behavior and customer behavior and market studies and so on would look at how kids play, when they play, what they play in, what toys they like, what they don't like, what women, what do girls like, what do boys like, what do you play with in different ages. We're not at all looking at that. We're looking at why they play. So think about it, right? It's so if somebody plays, why do they do it? Like, is there a human reason to do it? Is there a rational reason? Is there a social reason? And then we engaged in a very naive study, because at that time we didn't really have a method, set of methods that was rigorous in a sense. We knew we'd apply sort of fieldwork and anthropological techniques. But if you do that properly, it takes 3 years. Because you go to an island and study the tribe.
Yeah. Right?
And you do that, you have to learn the language first. Mm-hmm. Like, and then you stay there for months and you take notes and photos and you understand everything and so on. And it's the same, but we want to accelerate that into a 3 month project. But it worked, like wonders, I'd have to say. You'd go there and you'd talk to the mom, talk to the kid, and then you'd play with them. We made our own toys, made out of Velcro shapes and a big suitcase, and bring them and play with this non-branded toy.
Yeah.
And then see what stories they were telling. We'd draw with them, we'd have them tell stories to us every day. For me, it was a big revelation, because I learned a lot about method, really. But I also learned a lot about play and children. And how wonderfully complex children are, and not at all what adults think.
What were the conclusions from that 3 month study? What were the answers you delivered back to LEGO?
We looked at that sort of mirror, like what are the assumptions they're making, and then we compared it to what's reality. So you have a hypothesis that kids have no attention span, and you compare that to reality. And we found it's actually the other way around. We found children to have very, very deep interests in singular things for a very long time. All the 60 kids had some kind of interest that it had for at least 6 years, at least the older ones, the younger ones start to build them. Could be dinosaurs, could be submarines, could be sharks, could be maths, could be football, could be skateboarding. Kids that had been skateboarding for 6 years, and he would show us a trainer, and it was worn in the exactly right place, and he'd say, this sneaker, I could sell that for €1 million. I said, nah, I don't think so. And he was going, no, maybe it's 10 euros, but it's at least, you know, a lot. Right? And it turns out, why? Yes, because this shoe shows the other kids at the skateboard ramp that I know how to do a kickflipper. And it gives me a pass to what he called be king. In the skateboard ramp, which gives me the right to teach others how to do otherwise. So there was a hierarchy there, and so on. So we learned many things like that. So to sum it up, we learned that kids do not suffer from attention span. It's true that they multitask, but parents are not with kids, so they have no clue. What has happened is, you know, the family is dissolving, and children are in institutions all day, and they're with other adults. And no one is looking at them for their whole life anymore. Of course they play computer games. But then if you look at what computer games do you play, what books do you read, What pictures do you like? What are your fantasies? What are your dreams? What do you draw? All of a sudden you see, oh, it's all about dinosaurs. We learned about how they loved to master things. Like really mastery is a really big, like play, you play to master something, to master the world outside. A mobile phone is probably the only tool that parents, where parents are completely relaxed, that kids have that. Because it helps them to contact the kids and they can see where they are and stuff like that. But and for the kids, it's great because they can do things that are forbidden. Right? Mm. And so we learned about that sort of, we call that play as oxygen, meaning kids lack oxygen in their lives. They are kind of controlled by a lot of parents. Many kids are controlled by parents. Mm. I want my kids to be creative. I want them to be smart. I want them to be fun. I want them to be able to cook. I want them to be well behaved, but then kids can't do all these things, right? You have to, you know, and therefore they use play to find themselves and to find that oxygen that's me, right? Mm-hmm. And then we learned about hierarchy, which is a classic anthropological concept that human groups tend to put themselves into hierarchies. And we found that in a very, very, very physical way. So boys in Germany would have these carts of everything, carts of cars, carts of football players and so on. And they would know, you'd ask somebody in Germany, in Hamburg, a 9-year-old, who is the best Italian goalkeeper right now? Well, that's the goalkeeper from Milan, he's called this and this. And who's number two? You don't know this, okay. Who is the best, you know, who was the best, you know, attacker at the last World Cup? Oh, that's, who's number two, who's number three? Who's best in at maths in your school? Well, that's that girl. But who's number 17? But that's that boy. And we found that everything was put into hierarchy, like everything was put best, worst, like or number one, number nine, and so on. And today, of course, that's banal because look at Facebook or social media. It's that entire business model, in my view, is built on human need for hierarchy. That I, you want to know how many likes you have, how many followers you have, etc. Right? And there are even some of these social media where you. You know, then you become an influencer if you reach a certain stage and all of that. And it's quite evil, I think, not so ethical, but it's based on a human need, which is, tell me where I belong in the hierarchy.
In your book, A Moment of Clarity, you tell this whole story amongst other things. Well, I'm trying to remember the four conclusions. Where was it? Hierarchy, mastery, privacy.
And social skills.
Social skills.
Yeah.
And so you had those four precise answers, then turn that into oxygen.
The people like the CEO saw this study and they had a revelation. It happened on a specific day. That's why I call it the moment of clarity. Mm-hmm. And it's not a religious thing. You get so much data and so much real insight and so much real contextual information about who your customers are. And all of a sudden you see a pattern. There's a clear pattern. And the pattern is something you already knew, but it opens your eyes. And in this case, the pattern was, what is it that we have in Lego that gives mastery? So endless play, and you can build skills over time, and you can keep an interest for, let's say, 7, 8, 9 years. Mm. What is it we have that can produce higher sense of hierarchy, where am I in the order of things? What is it that can give kids social skills? And what is it that can make them build things or do things and play things that are forbidden? And then the CEO took a break and he said, we already knew this. Like, it's the brick. Hmm. And now it sounds banal.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a famous sociologist who wrote a book. It's called Everything is Banal Once You Know It. When I said it now, it might sound, oh, yeah, couldn't you have told? No, we had to go all the way to, you know, New Jersey, into a home, collect this deep, deep knowledge around who kids are, analyze it, find patterns to get to that place. And then when that revelation came, and they called it back to the brick, and out of it came also an idea about what Lego is really about, which is called Inspires the Builders of Tomorrow. We found that there's a group of kids that play to build. They don't build to play. They play to build. So they are typically also good at linear thinking. They're good at following instructions. They're very good at structured thought. They're very rational. They're super good with numbers. They have visual abilities that others don't have.
They can imagine what a building should look like and then build it. For them, Lego is a life-giving thing. It gives them a purpose in life. And also we found that many of those kids, if you look at some of the biggest inventors of our age, take Steve Jobs, and you read his biography, it turns out he played Lego when he was a kid. You look at the two Google founders, they say we could not have founded Google without Lego. Mm-hmm. You look at some of the biggest architects in the world, and they still built with Lego. They still use Lego. It is their the metaphor for who they are. And for me, that was also a big revelation. Like, okay, so what we're really doing, if you're really looking at the value we are creating in Lego is not to make kids happy. It's not entertainment. It's not software. It is helping the builders of tomorrow, the people that's going to inherit the society and build a new one, with thinking skills. So inspire the builders of tomorrow.
That in its very essence, that story, is the big difference between Red Associates as a consultancy to all others, in the sense that you don't go in a room and brainstorm. It's kind of, it took me a while to understand that, oh, you actually go and do this field work and come back with, you have to find that question first and you come back with answers, then you find the pattern and then you have the moments of clarity. Mm. And then you come up with the sort of back to the brick builders of tomorrow, because it's based on evidence.
And to be honest, it might sound easy, it's not easy to come to this sort of method. We did a lot of mistakes to get there, and we learned, and we boiled it down to a method that we call sense making now. You can repeat it, it's very rigorous, and it works every time. And the reason it does that is based on very simple principles, and one of which is that we try not to start with assumptions or hypotheses. And all, I would say nearly all business decisions you learn in business school, and then which is replicated in boardrooms and big consulting firms, is based on this idea of deductive reasoning, which is also economics, by the way, where you take a problem and you divide it into the smallest parts, and then you solve it from there. And that's a very particular way of solving a problem. But the thing is, if the first question is wrong, you're deducting the wrong thing, right?
Yeah.
And so we would say, no, we would not do that. We would start by figuring out what is the question. We call it a phenomena. So a good, for example, why do kids play is the question. If that's the question, you can't deduce that. You have to go and figure it out. So you take that, what you learn, the patterns you learn, and then you shape a new idea, for example, inspire the builders of tomorrow, these and these play lines, these and these and innovations. You take them to market. And so you're actually now influencing, you're taking your insights back into the real world, back to kids, that then get a new play experience. So it's like a circle, like find a solution, a pattern, take it into the real world, see what happens. Hopefully it works. Right? And so that's what we probably do today, more and more of. So and I think if you talk to my employees, they will use the term, I'm forced. I think I'm forced to take it into the real world or something like that.
Yeah.
And that's true. Because we take somebody who has a PhD in anthropology, who really wants to study something, and who really wants to describe the world, and we say, no, you have to prescribe, like a doctor, you have to say, how do you heal that company, or how do you heal society with whatever you're doing, if it's air quality, or shoes, or phones, or ethics. But take it back, and for me, That's the thing I'm excited about. It's not. I'm also excited about the methods, as you can hear. But it's only to get to that point where you can prescribe a solution.
So it was just about 10 years ago, I wrote my first book, Racing Through the Dark, and I didn't realize at the time. But the opening quote I use is reference to writing my autobiography, but it seems really applicable to what you guys are doing with Red Associates. It's a Somerset Maugham quote, and it's from his book, The Razor's Edge. And it goes something like this. It is very difficult to know people, and I don't think one can ever really know any but one's own countrymen. For men and women are not only themselves, they are also the region in which they were born, the city apartment or the farm in which they learnt to walk, the games they played as children, the old wives' tales they overheard, the food they ate, the schools they attended, the sports they followed, the poets they read, and the God they believed in. It is all these things that have made them what they are, and those are things that you can't come to know by hearsay. You can only know them if you have lived them. You can only know them if you are them.
Good description of the human condition, I think, yeah.
Yeah, I think my point,
very much, because it goes down to what you're saying about the application of anthropology to the world and making these business decisions and human sciences. And it gives me a little bit of comfort to think that in this world where we're panicking so much about computers and machines taking everything over, that actually beneath it all, we are still human.
Yes.
What is your view on that? And can you give hope to the fact that we're not going to turn into a machine world?
You know, first of all, I think I've learned the last 15 years a lot about what it means to be a human being and what it doesn't mean to be a human being, and also learned from encountering actually literally thousands of business people the very common sort of misconceptions about who we are, what it means to be human beings. And, I mean, the biggest one is that human beings are, machines, that we are algorithmic, that we are driven by utility and need. I think human beings are much more complex than we tend to think, for the reason that someone like Morgan wrote there, which is, and we would call, we are context dependent. Meaning, if I have to explain David Miller, one part is your psychology, your brain, your being, your body, your presence in a room. But there's also who you really are, which is where you come from, the ideas that you bring up, your language, your relationship to other people, your idea of goodness and the good life and so on, which is cultural, like, and it's not so decodable. It's not so, you can't just say, okay, computer, please do a David Miller copy, right? In most companies, it's the one thing they're not very good at is understanding their customers, like understanding their stakeholders, understanding, you know, what is it like to be a young person in Poland, right? What is it like to be a Chinese consumer? And what I see a lot of is this idea that people are algorithmic or you can replicate human behavior and we're not really needed. And I think that's not entirely true. Another really big one, misconception, I think, is the idea that human beings are individuals, basically, and have needs and make decisions out of some kind of rational calculation. If you take your quote there, it clearly says, when you're born into a world, and that world has predefined cultures and rules and norms. It has a hierarchy that's all there, already there. You're born into that. And then you can move up and move down socially, but you're born into it. And so it does make a difference where you're born and how your upbringing is, but it doesn't come from individuality. It comes from social pressure. It comes from norms, culture, status, things like that. And not a lot of companies understand it. And you can see that in how they spend their money on understanding customers. They, in the US, more than $80 billion are spent every year on what's called market research. And I looked into those methods, or we looked into them, and around, you could say 90% of those money is spent on one method. And the method is ask people what they need. Send them a survey, put them in a focus group, do an interview with them. Mm. Like, David, what do you need, right? Yeah. People don't need anything. And if they need something, they don't know. Mm. And most of our purchases and consumption have a depth where it's not just about, a shoe is not just a shoe, it means something, it gives you status, you don't choose a shoe, the shoe chooses you. You don't choose your education, the education chooses you. That particular idea is very, very hard for business to understand because it challenges the core idea in marketing, which is consumers have utility needs that you serve through product, price, placement, etc., which is actually not true. Consumers already live in a world. They are deeply influenced by social movements, by culture, by norm, by language, by power, by gender, family, all of those things. Mm-hmm. And those are the things we think. I'm not saying it's the only thing to understand, because sometimes you have to ask, do you like the door red or green? Mm-hmm. But most of the time, I think it makes more sense to figure out why do people even have a car?
I mean, I'm one of the people that will say this, and this kind of gives me a bit of hope. At the moment when we are living in a borderline culture of paranoia regards machines knowing more about us than we know about them or about each other,
actually we shouldn't perhaps over concern ourselves with that and actually put a bit more time into getting to know people.
Yes, I think that's a good conclusion. And I think generally it's a good idea to be critical, but I don't think it's a good idea to be paranoid. And I think most of the time we figure it out, right? And I think we will figure. I think it's very, very interesting, and I don't have the answers to how does particularly social media and the existence of that you can have a presence online. That's you can be online, which will probably be even more and more in the future when you have things like face recognition, and they can basically replicate how you wrote and stuff like that. Like, what does it then mean to be a human being? That's a deep philosophical question. Is it okay to take people's data and make money on it, for example? Is it okay to surveil people? I think if you ask majority of human scientists, they would say we are probably at a stage now where we've got to think and we have to be cautious, not going too far, because in human history, a lot of bad things happened because people were surveyed. And probably we're at a stage now where we don't know what we're doing. A little bit like smoking. Like, it used to be super cool, and then, oh no, it causes cancer, right? And maybe we shouldn't do it. So the precautionary principle, I think, is a good guideline sometimes. And I think I'll be there, but I would not be paranoid.
Thank you, Mikael. That's been brilliant.